Imagine a world where forming policy was less about cutting through red tape and more about listening to people for building a better tomorrow. Two of the most widely discussed issues facing our society today center around climate and economic inequality. While many people are divided on these issues, there are a variety of ideas involving how they should be handled. We were curious to know what the younger generation thought about these topics. So in May 2021, we brought together more than 600 young people from across the country, some students, some non-students, some just out of high school, others closer to their 30th birthdays. They were all brought together online to discuss their insights on these issues in small groups. They then listened to panels of experts that answered their questions and interacted with each other regardless of whether they agreed on the topics being discussed. From the team that brought you Voices of America in One Room, this is Voices of Shaping Our Future.
My name is Alice. I'm the Associate Director at the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University.
In this special episode of the podcast, we have the privilege of sitting down with a group of thought leaders for a roundtable discussion about the Berggruen Institute's Youth Environmental Service, or YES campaign. Let's meet our panelists.
My name is Azam Almoui. I am an anthropologist, and I currently work for the Los Angeles Conservation Corps Service.
My name is Mark Paul. I'm an assistant professor of economics and environmental studies at the New College of Florida and a fellow at the Berggruen Institute.
Hi, everyone. My name is Christy Drutman. I'm a Jewish Filipina environmental educator and media host of my own podcast and media series called Brown Girl Green. Happy to be here.
I'm Mary Ellen Sprinkle, the president and CEO of the CORE Network, which is the National Association of Service and Conservation Corps.
And now, let me pass it over to Berggruen Institute Executive Vice President Don Nakagawa for some background on YES.
Hello and welcome to Shaping Our Future podcast. I am Don Nakagawa from the Berggruen Institute, and this episode is about the YES campaign. The YES campaign is a project of the Berggruen Institute that grew out of our Renovating Democracy work, which started a few years ago with digital disruption and what we were seeing in the marketplace of democratic institutions and conversations. And from that work, we came to the conclusion that what we need to do is really reinvent our democracy. And one of the key components of that is figuring out what the new civic architecture needs to be for the 21st century. That civic architecture needs to bring people together and develop a skill set for talking across very diverse topics and different value sets and certainly different political orientations. And as we thought through how do you build a society that is capable of having these very difficult conversations and solving problems together, we landed on the idea of YES. So at the same time as we were developing what this new civic architecture needed to look like, there was an enormous amount of energy from young people around climate. The extinction events were happening, and that movement was taking place across the globe. We saw this and thought, isn't this an opportunity to harness that energy and do it in a way that's really civically engaged? And we came up with something called the YES program, Youth Environmental Service. The idea when we came up with it is how do we, again, bring young people together and develop skill sets across very different sets of maybe values, languages, cultures, and so on, certainly political differences, and have them work together with common cause. And it appears that all the stats indicate that young people are very, very concerned about climate and their future in it. So that's how we presented YES. But another part of the work that we're doing is about civic engagement, and it is about actually integrating processes for civic engagement in our governance systems, in our democracy, much more so than today. So rather than approaching democracy as one person, one vote, we were thinking it's government for and by the people, and there are lots of ways to do that. So we started looking at citizens' assemblies, deliberative processes, and so on. And we were familiar with the work of James Fishkin. We've been, actually, he was engaged with us for years on this topic. And so it was one of the first places we looked. We went to Stanford and tried to figure out if there was a way that we could work together and what we could learn from that process. And here we landed on the Stanford Practicum. So we have a wonderful group here today who participated in the practicum, some of the people who ran the practicum, to talk about what the questions were that were asked and which ones referred to yes. The most important thing that I think we've learned through the process and that we've sort of come to discover is how important young people's voices are in shaping what our climate policy and programs are. It's really critically important. It's their future that's at stake. And in many ways, I think the Berggruen Institute feels like we need to put the reins of the climate fight in their hands. And the sooner we do it, the more equipped we're going to be to manage the challenge and address it. And the more equipped they will be for the future that they face. So that's what the practicum was about asking them some of the questions about programs like YES and civic service programs like the Climate Corps in California or the Conservation Corps that's all across the country, and how we could shape it towards, towards facing the challenge and addressing the challenges we face, and actually wrap it into this robust conversation, this robust policy conversation that's taking place around environment, around investment in climate, and youth engagement in those processes. So without further ado, I will hand it over to Alice Hsu, who is the Associate Director for the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford, and our wonderful panel of activists and researchers on this topic of civic service and youth engagement, and actually the current policy conversation that's going on. So thank you so much for everybody who's listening today and for our participants, and I'll hand it over to Alice.
Well, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us today. We have an excellent roundtable of panelists with us. It is just wonderful to have such a group of experts here talking to us about the relevance of the YES program and just the climate national service and what it means to be doing national service in our country. Would all of you just like to give us a hello so we can hear your voices?
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, this is Mark Ball.
Hi, it's Mary Ellen.
Great. Now we recognize everyone's voices. All right, panel, I'm going to start off easy. The first question, most of our listeners here, they're tuning in because they're concerned about the climate. They're concerned about our environment. And the recent announcement, the current administration is proposing a civilian climate corps program to employ thousands of people to work on green projects. And in shaping our future in the deliberation, our participants talked about this program, and there was a lot of support, over 90% of support for a program like this. But in the discussions, people had hesitation and were concerned. All of you are experts in this area, and I would love for you to share with our listeners, what are your thoughts on this proposal for a very ambitious climate corps program that's being proposed? What are your views on this?
After reading the proposal from the, I think it was a January 27th executive order, I thought that it was a good idea, but there weren't a lot of concrete and sort of material goals for the civilian corps. And I think civilian corps have been effective in the past for America as a medium for conservation, but I think we have to be critical of what effective means in this case and who we're centering in these conversations. And I think putting, as a young person working for a civilian climate corps in the urban sector, I think we have to also focus where we're putting the weight of this burden. While young people can certainly be effective, there are externalities and certain things where no matter how we organize, there's just things that we won't be able to reverse. So I think it's important also to look at the systems that we're creating to combat this climate crisis.
Mark, Mary Ellen, Christy, who would like to jump in next?
I'm happy to hop in. So thanks, Alice, for that question. I think this is a really exciting time in the climate space. We're seeing real movement on the creation of a new civilian climate corps. Both President Biden has announced that as one of his top three priorities in terms of policies to address climate change. And Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer came out in strong support of this policy last week, backing the proposal put forth by the Sunrise Movement and introduced by Senator Ed Markey and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I want to back up for a moment, though. When we think about creating a new civilian climate corps, details matter. And you mentioned, Alice, putting thousands of people to work. There's a difference between putting thousands of people to work, putting hundreds of thousands of people to work, and putting millions of people to work. President Biden put forth a proposal to spend $10 billion. To put that into perspective, that would employ about 25,000 Americans, which would create a program 1/60th the size of the initial CCC. So we're talking about a really minuscule program here. It actually would employ less than AmeriCorps currently employs in the US. Senator Markey and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, by contrast, called for $132 billion. That would employ about 1.5 million Americans over 5 years. So it's a much more sizable program. And right now, what this actually looks like in terms of the policy context is we'll most likely see the battle occur during the reconciliation bill. And there we'll actually determine if this is a $10 billion program or $132 billion program. And size really matters, which gets to your other point you brought up, which is that participants were concerned about, quote, the costs and financial burden of this program. So I look at this as an economist, and what, the message that I want to get across is that the two costly things that we should be concerned with aren't the financial outlays for the program, but instead are A, the cost of climate change. And what I mean there is the real debt we are leaving future generations isn't the national debt. It's as a matter of fact, it's, what is the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere? That's the real debt we should be concerned about as an economist. The second thing is unemployment is incredibly costly. Right now, we have youth unemployment in double digits still. And as a matter of fact, from an economic perspective, the U.S. government could put these people to work doing meaningful and remunerative employment. And actually, I believe that the program would, in effect, pay for itself by eliminating unemployment, by increasing spending power in the economy, which then goes out and creates more jobs. So my calculations show, okay, if we spend $132 billion on the program, we create 1.5 million jobs for America's youth. But that would actually then go out and create an additional 400,000 jobs in the economy. Because what do we all do with our money? We go buy dinner. We go out to drinks with friends. We pay our rent. We pay our healthcare bill. And that actually creates more jobs. So this program shouldn't be thought of as a costly program to the taxpayer, but should actually be thought of as a meaningful way to address our unemployment problem and our climate crisis that we face right now and a way to spur economic growth.
Thank you, Mark. Christy or Mayellen?
Yeah, I wanted to weigh in on this. Just in terms of talking about equity and diversity and inclusion with this program, a lot of people praise the original, CCC as providing, hundreds of thousands of jobs, but it was mostly for like privileged white folks, which is fine. But like at the end of the day, it was short-term employment, which got the job done, which was amazing. It got us into the place that we needed to get the infrastructure we needed. But with this program, with how small of a budget was mentioned, if there's not the budget there, then how are you going to actually create, a livable wage for people, including healthcare benefits, including things that are going to actually make them want to be involved. And they claim in this program that it's going to lead to young people having career pathways into outdoor and environmental employment. But as those of us who have been in the environmental field know, there's still a lot of equity issues, even in the environmental field, especially for Black, Indigenous, and people of color to have long-term sustainable careers in this field. If you see the Green 2.0 report, it talks about the lack of equity in a majority of mainstream green environmental nonprofits. So my only concern is who is going to be the face in this program? And if it is, like, what is the scalability and what is the message it's trying to send to the everyday American? Is it trying to say, we're saving the planet, or we're actually meeting communities where they're at and actually figuring out, there's these organizers on the ground that have been doing this work to try to protect the environment and fighting against extractive industries. Why is the funding not going towards them and building resilience on the ground where they already live? So I'm just wondering where the gap is there, and I don't have all the information, but I'm just concerned, especially with what was just mentioned, that the budget is so significantly small. And so I really hope that, you know, bills and legislation is passed to address that equity gap. Otherwise, we're not going to see a very multicultural or diverse workforce actually come out of this and spread a message to more Americans that this is something worth investing in.
Thank you, Christy. Mary Ellen.
I think everyone who's spoken so far has raised some really valid concerns. And as the director of the National Association of the Existing Network of Service and Conservation Corps, we've actually been pretty engaged with the administration and Congress about what this should look like. And indeed, the devil is in the details. It is my sense that the $10 billion and 25,000 Corps members is a starting point for fiscal year 22, with growth scheduled thereafter. We have been very clear that in order to make this an equitable program and accessible to all people, it needs to have a livable wage. It needs to have access to education and workforce development, in some cases, maybe supportive services like childcare, transportation, healthcare. It's going to be costly, but it's my sense that this administration gets that. In addition, this is a long-term game. So we've been talking with the administration and Congress about how to build in, how to work with employers and union labor to make these pre-apprenticeship experiences that could lead to good union paying jobs. And so far, I've been actually working in advocacy and legislative policy for about 30 years, and I have to say that there has never been sort of more a receptive climate and understanding around what needs to happen to make this successful in terms of gauging all Americans. We've also been really vocal about making sure that the project work can happen in all communities. So it's not just through the Department of Interior and Agriculture, but it's happening in Brooklyn, New York, in Los Angeles, where AZAM is already working with the Los Angeles Conservation Corps. So that work is already going on. We just need to make sure that it continues to happen. So we've been advocating for project work through the Department of Transportation, Housing and Urban Development, EPA, and I think we have been kind of, our primary message has been, this has got to be a government-wide endeavor. It can't just be situated at one agency and be effective.
Thank you. I really appreciate everyone's different perspectives and thoughts on this. There's so much to circle back to. All of your comments, they're so meaty and heavy. And I think one of them, Christy, I'm going to start with yours first with equity. And I'd love to hear everyone's thoughts on what Christy said with respect to equity. And this was actually one of the bigger topics that participants in Shaping Our Future brought up. How do you encourage people? How do you tell people, you know, those that are low wage income families or, you know, that need jobs with a higher income? And I wonder how all of you would address it. And, you know, obviously, you know, Mark, you're coming from it with the numbers, and Azam, you're living and breathing it, and Mary Ellen, you have so much vast experience, you know, with the whole network and dealing with these issues. If you could tell our listeners, how do you see this equity issue, and how can you all address it in what you do, and is there something the listeners can do as well?
You know, I think first of all, we should back up and be honest about the roots of the original CCC. As Christy pointed out, the initial CCC was a racist program. It segregated work camps. It excluded women. It was a program tailored towards young white men. And I think we should be honest about that. That said, that means that any new civilian conservation corps needs to put equity front and center. And that's actually precisely what the bill introduced by AOC and Senator Marquis does. It directs 50% of funding towards environmental justice communities and ensures that 50% of people hired come directly out of EJ communities. And as Christy pointed out, keeps them in their communities
So not only do those investments stay and happen in the community, but the dollars paid to those workers stay in the community. So I think that, you know, centering equity and being smart about this is crucial to any just transition away from fossil fuels, whether it be through the Civilian Climate Corps or other programs. The second thing is, you know, we need to get away from creating and supporting poverty employment in this country. I have a lot of problems with AmeriCorps. The number one being 75% of AmeriCorps workers earn $14,000 a year or less. The program creates poverty employment. The government should not be in that business. The government should be in the business of creating good living wage jobs. So how do we make these, you know, decent jobs? We pay the workers. It really is that simple. So paying them a minimum of $15 an hour, providing them with government health care, providing them with education stipends. AmeriCorps provides $4,000. That doesn't get you anywhere these days. The one introduced by AOC and Senator Markey provides $25,000 a year in education stipend to workers. So this actually gives people a pathway and a leg up. And you know, the best way to do that, again, is just paying people good money for fair work. And in terms of recruiting people, you know, these jobs, if we actually get those types of stipulations, are better than about, you know, a 1 in 4 jobs in this country, unfortunately. So I think that there's a lot of promise to not only creating a lot of jobs for this program, but also creating quality jobs and directing them to the communities that need quality employment the most.
I think I can pick up from there. And equity is something that we center at the Los Angeles Conservation Corps, or at least try our best to. Our main workforce is 18 to 24-year-olds who come from the area that they're working in. And we have programs to help people get their licenses, programs to help people finish high school, very much so looking at the issues as they come, even offering, you know, connecting with local housing agencies and whatnot. And, you know, even myself, coming from somewhat of a privileged background, like this opportunity is, but still the best of sort of Conservation Corps offerings. Like, you know, AmeriCorps, as you mentioned, they pay very little, and here even paying Los Angeles minimum wage is much better than that. And, you know, I'm sure we all have thoughts on minimum wage and whatnot, but in Los Angeles, that's not enough to even live. You know, I mentioned a privileged background, and I meant being able to live with my parents, being able to, you know, different things on the ground that are, you know, holding a lot of people who want to engage in this space back from engaging. And like you mentioned, with the original iteration of the Civilian Conservation or the Civilian Climate Corps, it's a very loaded thing, because even the very land that we come from, the land that we're working from, there are so many issues with who does the land belong to? Who are the most vulnerable, and who are we, you know, centering? How can we even build the foundation to start moving forward on these things if we can't recognize, you know, all the issues with it?
So I completely agree that AmeriCorps, it was designed for middle-class young people to give back. It was, and it needs to be changed in order to make it available to all young people. As Mark pointed out, that $14,000 a year for a full-time member is the maximum. Core members can earn and do earn quite a bit less. The Corps and the Corps Network are a little bit unique in the AmeriCorps space, because more than 50% of the young people in service and conservation corps are young people of color, and also come from below families or communities from below the poverty line. And corps are able to make that work and pay corps members more than the maximum stipend, by pulling in a number of funding streams. So they get Department of Labor funding to provide job training. They do Department of Interior for the land management work that they do. So we know that it probably takes more like $40,000 per Corps member per year to successfully engage a young person. And someone facing multiple barriers to employment might be even significantly higher than that. I am encouraged by the fact that this administration has made a commitment to $15 an hour minimum wage, including healthcare. And it seems that all of the bills, Senator Markey's bill, and others, they all have adopted this $15 minimum wage. So I think that there is becoming this general recognition that AmeriCorps as is not an option for many low-income young people. I think also the positive side of that is I don't think that the administration and Congress is looking at this just for the Civilian Climate Corps, but for all AmeriCorps programs, which would be, I think, a really great and positive change for the entire program.
If I could quickly speak again, I think working sort of on the ground in these corps that, you know, they're trying to build, I just think that while policy is certainly very important, I think that what I have seen on the ground that's more important and more effective is organizing in our own communities. While it is a federal, it's a national, it's a global issue, it's something that happens much more at a localized level and something where the people on the ground are helping each other the most. I think in the different climate crises that have recently struck even the United States, like the freeze in Texas and the heat wave in the Pacific Northwest, mutual aid networks and things that are organized horizontally instead of vertically are much more dynamic and flexible to facing these issues. And I think that an important thing with core jobs is giving people skills that they can then go back and share with their community. You know, having these things be horizontal and for, you know, more than just people who have access to the positions and the jobs themselves.
Azam, you bring up a really good point, and then it was another point I wanted to touch on that Mary Ellen also shared initially about engaging the entire government across all departments. And Azam, what you're saying about doing things locally. You know, one of the proposals in our discussion for that weekend was how important it was to engage the most vulnerable populations and communities in the structure of the Climate Corps program or in making decisions about which projects to do and what would be most effective. And Azam, the way you described it, it's almost beyond the structure. It's like getting into the roots of communities in order to make those real differences. And it also appears there's disconnects between what nationally wants to be done, but what really locally needs to happen. And I don't really know how to resolve that disconnect between making real impact and having a national structure that could be effective. And I don't know what the answer is, Azam or Mary Ellen. How do we ensure that this new program or any program or existing programs rather can revamp themselves, you know, more in the likes of what Azam's doing in LA, or have those real impacts at local levels that are so needed?
I think it starts with organizing. That's where it started for me. And that's where, you know, just seeing the needs as they come, because I think the fact is that, the climate has changed. We're in the middle of the crisis where it's happening now in different places throughout the United States. And in Los Angeles, you know, I've seen community fridges pop up. I've seen water drops when there's heat waves, giving people, you know, frozen water, giving houses people frozen water bottles, or, you know, housing for trans people. And I think mutual aid is a way to organize those things, you know, not just roots, but sort of like rhizomatic horizontal organizations, you know? And that to me has been something that's so powerful and something working in the core that I try to empower other people to work with and talking to the community members. That's something that I see as part of the, you know, when I'm out in communities planting trees to, you know, grow and create canopies and shade for the future, carbon sink and all that. Just talking to people, I think, and getting people involved. Like we mentioned earlier, I believe, about like directly democratic assemblies in neighborhoods and, you know, sort of showing people the power and autonomy that they have to counteract these big issues.
But how do you replicate that nationally? How do you do what you're doing across the country?
It is happening to some extent. And Los Angeles Conservation Corps is an amazing example. Green City Force in New York City. And here's an example of where funding comes from the federal level. It goes to New York City Public Housing Authority. The Public Housing Authority, which is made up of residents, decides what projects get done. All of the core members are public housing residents. All of the projects happen on public housing property. So it can be urban gardens. It can be weatherizing and retrofitting low-income housing that belongs to the housing authority. So I do, in Miami, CORES are doing work right in Miami, similar to what is going on in LA, in Austin, Texas, in Denver, in Seattle. So it is going on, but to really, I think scale is one, the funding, obviously, and making sure that the funding comes from the right channels and with the right instructions. It's got to go down to the communities, and the communities have got to have a role in deciding where the money goes. In terms of, I think the grassroots organizing that Azam has been talking about, it is critical. And I will say, Service and Conservation CORES are a little bit limited. All AmeriCorps programs are a little bit limited in terms of the amount of advocacy and organizing that they are able to do. So some, we either have to address that through statute, or we need to sort of make that happen organically outside of the CORE, which I think is what Azam has been doing in his community.
I agree with a lot of what's been said so far, but I just want to double down on one thing, which is that I don't really see much of a conflict between the local and national level here. The job of the National Civilian Climate Corps is to provide resources so that local levels can do the work on the ground. And I think what that means is that we need a program that's sufficiently flexible to allow local communities to decide, hopefully through some democratic means, what are the programs their local and their regional CCC is going to engage in. And I think that to me is how we unify the local and the federal. There's a lot of energy at the local level, but what there isn't is sufficient resources. Now, a city like LA doesn't have the means to put 100,000 youth to work in the city over the next couple of years, to plant millions of trees, to retrofit homes across the city, to retrofit schools and libraries, to do other meaningful both mitigation and adaptation work to address the climate crisis that we're in the midst of right now.
Yeah, I wanted to build off of that. Again, it comes back to the narrative we're building, right? So it's about, like, what is the symbolism on a national level? And the whole idea is not just employing Americans, but saying that there's a return on investment to American communities by caring about the environment, by caring about climate change. Again, so if that's the priority on a narrative and a branding standpoint, then we have to think about, okay, this is kind of like the blueprint. How can, like, state senators across the U.S. pass legislation that builds off of, you know, the previous racist history of the CCC and actually creates, like, a new and improved one that is going to emphasize that return on investment to unemployed Americans, to BIPOC, to women, to people that, you know, have not had those same kinds of employment opportunities, with also the return on investment that, like, communities are going to become healthier, cleaner, and more livable. Because I think across the board, no matter what, like, your political ideology is, I think people can agree that everyone deserves access to a clean, healthy, and equitable environment. And so I think it's about focusing on, like, how are we cleaning up and improving our communities while also making sure that, like, our politicians, no matter what their political standpoint is backing this, you know, because it's like, it's a shared agenda that I think everyone can benefit from. So I would just say that, like, when we're thinking about scalability, I think there are state senators, as was mentioned, that have been trying to think about new legislation. And I think that's, like, how we create the momentum for more people to support policy like this.
That is really, really helpful. And I want to shift to something that I can't remember exactly who said it initially, but there was something about making the CORE a career option, something that was more than just a 1 year or 2 year stint. And this was actually brought up by the participants in the event too. They were very confused as to why it was just offered as a kind of stopover, a stepping stone to something. And they didn't understand why, well, if it's so important to care about the climate and take on a job like this, why can't there be career options that are built into this program so that
if they commit themselves, they know that, you know, this is more than just doing it for a year or two. They could have a real career built into this. Is that possible with what's existing, the options that are existing now, or what's being planned?
Absolutely. It's both possible. It is going on, and it should be built in to whatever is designed to stand this up. For example, most concert or in federal statute, there exists something called non-competitive hiring authority. So core members who serve a certain number of hours on qualified projects are then eligible for federal jobs without going through the whole process within the federal land management agencies. That could be expanded to state and local kinds of job training. A number of corps partner, as I said, with unions to do sort of a pre-apprenticeship where young people are going directly into full apprenticeship programs and then into union jobs. And that's happening, and it should happen and be built into it. We have suggested that there also be a grant program at the Department of Labor specifically to develop the workforce development aspects of this program. So like I said, young people with multiple barriers to employment have the same access to jobs, to have that intensive employment experience. Industry recognized credentials need to be built into this. We've talked with private partners about would they commit to hiring or at least interviewing CCC graduates. So I think that there are a number of things that are going on and certainly can be built into this that make them long-term career pathways. And in fact, if we don't do it that way, we are doing a great disservice to the young people who go through it as well as the workforce.
So I think this is a really important question here. I think that there's two things for us to consider. I mean, first is that the Civilian Climate Corps will provide people with meaningful and remunerative employment for 1 to 2 years. That's vital because the biggest hindrance to a worker in finding a job today is currently being unemployed. The last thing an employer wants to hire is an unemployed worker. And in particular for the youth, given the current crisis that we're in the midst of, we know from previous crises that graduating, whether that be high school or college, into an economic recession is associated with what we call long-term scarring for these workers. In other words, their incomes and their economic and in turn human well-being is permanently lower simply because they graduated at an unfortunate time. And programs like this can really help provide a true safety net in America to ensure that fewer and fewer people are left behind. So I think that that part's really important. Second, you know, I think if we develop it properly, you know, as they always say, the devil's in the details, the Civilian Climate Corps can and should work with unions in order to create pipeline programs so that, you know, these workers in the CCC go directly into well-paying union careers in green industries. Let's keep in mind that the first and third fastest growing jobs in America right now are in green energy. So the industries are booming. And as the federal government invests more and more in decarbonization, there's going to be even more job creation. And people who actually have green job experience, like CCC core members, will, with you know the proper dots being connected, really be at the top of the list for this growing industry. So I think that you know what we need are complementary investments in green energy writ large, as well as tight pipelines to funnel workers from this program to longstanding union careers.
Azam, I'm curious to hear your opinion on this. You're living and breathing it right now. What's your trajectory? What are their trajectories? What is it like?
My personal trajectory is interesting because at the beginning of the pandemic, I was in grad school to become an anthropologist, and I sort of had a professional crisis where I realized I didn't want to be in the ivory tower anymore, so I quit. And then I had moved to this sector, the green sector, conservation. And my time with the Los Angeles Conservation Corps has been good. It connects, a lot of people are in this to get connected to union jobs, to get connected to government jobs. But I think broadening those organizations, it's so competitive to, you know, get into those careers as it stands that I think it's almost unrealistic for the people that the Corps serves sometimes to get those jobs. You know, they end up in a multitude of places instead of into these sectors where they could be, you know, further in conservation efforts. Personally, you know, because of my background, I feel like I've been able to capitalize on some of these opportunities, but I don't know if the pipelines are necessarily there because, again, it's like you have to either move on to a different core or move far away from home, and people don't want to be displaced. People don't want to, you know, there are certain things that are very difficult for people in making those moves, in creating those pipelines that would be, you know, effective.
The Los Angeles Conservation Corps is probably the one of the best examples in the country of a Green Career Pathways program. They have four tracks, I think one in energy, water, green infrastructure, and there is another one. But the Corps members sort of get to experiment with different kinds of projects and figure out what they like and pick a specific career pathway where then they receive industry recognized credentials, very specific skills, and then are sort of funneled into these green jobs. Philadelphia is another great example. They have career academies in sort of green job areas, and they're very intentional partnerships with employers to make sure that young people are going into jobs. From my perspective, that is the key and probably the biggest challenge is making the connection between the training and the jobs. Mark mentioned that, you know, more jobs are being generated in green infrastructure and clean energy. I think that just we need to sort of pay attention to how that happens to make sure that the training aligns with the job availabilities and that the employers are connected with the training programs. But I do think it's doable.
That's very helpful to know that some of these offices in the country are really striving to reach that and have that breadth. My next question may be a little controversial. It's about loan forgiveness. So a lot of participants actually, and there was a question in the survey too, about if the program offered loan forgiveness, whether they would join. They got obviously very high support. And is there any possibility that joining the Corps could lead to loan forgiveness? I see nodding from Mark. Does the math work out? I mean, that would encourage a lot of people to join.
I mean, the math absolutely works out. I mean, I think when we ask questions like that, we should think about what is the sticking point? Is it the resources? Does the U.S. government have the financial ability to cancel student debt for everybody? First of all, the answer is there, yes. Do we have the ability to cancel student debt for Corps members? Absolutely. What's being talked about is a $25,000 a year education stipend for Corps members, up to $50,000 for their 2 years of service. So that could either be used to pay down existing debt, or it could be used to spend to go back and get additional education if somebody wanted. So it provides people with that choice. I think that getting an education provision in the Civilian Climate Corps is not only likely, but is essential because it's you know, crucial that we kind of unshackle the youth from this indentured servitude that we've created through the student debt crisis. And, you know, I'll add that the canceling that student debt is actually quite popular. And it's not only popular amongst the youth, but it's popular across the U.S. population. So really the constraining factor we should be concerned with here is a political one. It's not one about resources. It's do we have the votes to push student debt cancellation through? And I think doing it for Corps members is an excellent start. Of course, I'd rather see it done across the economy writ large. I would actually argue that would have a larger positive economic benefit on the economy. It would unleash a substantial amount of spending power amongst our youth to go out there and buy things. And you know what that does? That creates more jobs. And that's exactly what we need right now. I mean, the economy is still down 10 million jobs from where it was before the crisis struck.
My next question actually is about something that you may have expected actually in the discussions. Some people had never heard of National Service. No knowledge. Like the first time they logged into Shaping Our Future was the first time they encountered something called National Service. They had no idea what it was, let alone AmeriCorps or the Civilian Climate Corps that's being proposed. And one of the participants we interviewed was in a rural place in Pennsylvania where people were making, you know, below minimum wage. And she said that her friends, her community would have benefited from people from AmeriCorps or other conservation corps programs to come in and talk about
what these core programs are about and recruit them. So I'm, all of you here know, we all know so much about the core programs now, but how do we get more people to know about what being about being a part of a core network is, or being what a core member is? How, Azam, how did you hear about it? I mean, how do we get this out there so it becomes more popular, so perhaps it creates more demand for programs like these? Azam, I'd love to start with you, just to figure out how you heard about it first and then decided to join.
Right. So it was something that I was personally like already inherently interested in. So I had actually been perusing jobs with like the Forest Service and with like the National Park. And I saw that that was kind of unrealistic. There was no like very little entry level jobs for that. You have to sort of have experience before you're able to, you know, breach into those organizations. So then I was looking for accredited conservation corps through the website, you know, because they connect, that's where they point young people towards who have no experience in that realm. And I found the Los Angeles Conservation Corps that was local to me. But I think my opinion would be, insofar as getting people to, people who are the most vulnerable, who we do want to center in these cases, I think it comes back to organizing again. You know, if everybody spoke to their neighbor, that's the entire country. I mean, that's sort of a, it's not even necessarily about scale. I just think it's something that people will care about if it's framed the correct way. And I think it is something that most people do care about, but they just, you know, they have the talking, it's very reductive, the narrative that people are presented with, when it is very personal, it is something that affects us all. And I think people will easily see that, you know, when you talk to them at a, you know, where they're at.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, like, I learned about the core when I was an undergrad at UC Berkeley. You know, they constantly came to a lot of college fairs, and I thought that was really useful. But again, like, I and a lot of other people were like, I want like a job that's gonna like actually pay my bills when I graduate. So we kind of just skipped over it. But I think if there's an opportunity to be like, oh, obviously this program hasn't like existed before, but just to be like, oh, these are some examples of jobs like you could get afterwards, and like to have some more research on like, yeah, just some more of security or guarantee that's going to lead you into like the networks you're going to need to succeed and thrive later on in the field. I think that's really important. So if they do send representatives to educate people, like was just discussed, there needs to be like really good storytelling involved.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree with a lot of what's been said here, especially the last point about storytelling. I think that's so important. And actually, it's something that core members can and should do. A lot of people don't understand the climate science very well. It's complex. And I can only imagine sending thousands of core members across communities into every nook and cranny of this country to help educate people about what's going on with our one and only planet. But addressing your question, you know, how do we get the message out? I mean, I think this, again, comes back to resources. And it comes back to resources in two ways. One is actually funding the program appropriately, so there are plenty of jobs to be had, and funding the programs so that they have, you know, overheads so that they can go into communities, and in particular environmental justice communities, and recruit people. And then second, again, making them good jobs. A lot of people don't know about it, but it's also because a lot of times outreach isn't done in communities where people can't afford to engage in national service. National service shouldn't be a sacrifice. It should, you know, again, be something that pays well and provides people with a decent living and a real pathway to improving their long-term well-being through a good career in the green environmental space.
I would agree. Everybody has sort of hit it. For me, it comes down sort of to three things. Resources, you need to be able to fund recruiters to go into communities. The U.S. military gets about $10 billion, which is what we're proposing for the entire cost of this program just on recruiting. And they recruit about the same number of young people as AmeriCorps member does every year, between 75,000 and 80,000. AmeriCorps has a team of maybe three or four at the national headquarters. Programs don't have funding to go into communities. Also, we all have to start thinking about going through different channels. We know that AmeriCorps, at least in other national service programs, are pretty well tapped into the college communities and going through that avenue. But they, to Mark and to Christy's point, they need to go into communities of underserved EJ communities that would have never heard of AmeriCorps. And then I think the third point, which we've discussed, is the value proposition. You've got to make it worth people's while. You've got to make it doable, affordable for them to do it. And then you have to sell it or storytell it in such a way that people are understanding that this is a career pathway, that it's not, that the benefit that they are getting is equal to or greater than the benefit to the community.
Wow, Mary Ellen, thank you for sharing that data point about the budget for recruitment in comparison. On that note, I mean, Mark and Azam and Chrissy, you've all brought up the point about resources. Is there something listeners can do? What would you say to them, those that are listening, that really want to help the Corps increase membership or increase resources? What is something that a listener can do?
Call your elected official. Right now, you know, how much resources are going to go into this program is still very much up for debate. This is moving through the reconciliation process. And, you know, whether we get $10 billion or $60 billion or $132 billion, that's kind of these are the extremes that the program's being discussed between, is just still an open question. So call your elected official, demand that they go big on this program. The youth want to work. The youth want to contribute to the climate crisis. Let's give them that chance.
I agree. Weigh in with your elected officials, state, local, and federal. And tell other people about it.
Yeah, I would just say that's like probably the biggest thing, because ultimately it comes down to resources, and the people that are going to determine that are the ones that are going to actually sign this in and actually advocate and be able to create the pathways to, you know, disperse that education to people on the ground.
Azam, what do you think?
I think that, you know, getting people to join this core definitely, it completely relies on the resources that we're willing to put towards it. But more than that, I've just been thinking throughout this that, you know, the core, while important, I think that, like, we need to focus on local level issues. Like, I mean, not local level issues. We need to, you know, engage in mutual aid in your own community. Like, they want to give this program $10 billion. That's, you know, a drop in the bucket to the military budget, to the things that we're doing around, you know, the resources are there. They're there to fund everything that we need. The fact is that they're not willing to put them in that place, you know? And for me, as someone working in my own community and in the different community work that I've done, I think that we're going to help each other through these things more so than motivating each other to join the core. I think for me, the utility of these cores is giving people the skills they need to implement it in their own, you know, to whatever scale they want to affect. So to get more people to join the core, you know, I think just tell each other and add the utility and the resources.
On that note, since, you know, you are all advocates and experts in this area, I'd love to give all of you the platform to get a message out. I'd love to hear what your message is to our listeners.
I just want to say that, like, I just think that the fate of climate solutions in this country and in this world is dependent on specifically supporting Black, Indigenous, and people of color, especially our young people. If we're going to see any scalability or success in climate policy in the next decade or, you know, the next 50 years, that needs to be at the forefront, because currently those resources aren't being equitably distributed. So if you know about environmental justice organizations in your community, if you know other like young BIPOC who you feel deserve support to thrive in this field, please redistribute your resources, be able to identify where the gaps are and to name it and educate people around you about it as often as possible. And be able to support young people of color like myself and support me and Brown Girl Green. So thanks.
My message to folks is talk about the climate. Every day, make it a mission to talk to your family, your friends, your loved ones, strangers about climate change. We are in the midst of a climate crisis. It's here. It's not something for future generations. It's something we're dealing with today in the present. You know, those of you who saw the photos of the flooding New York subway yesterday or the flooding streets of London today know that extreme weather events are on the rise and they're being fueled by warmer temperatures.
The second thing is I want to say organize, whether that's, you know, with your local communities, whether that's with national chapters like the Sunrise Movement. You know, our voices together are much more powerful than our voices as individuals. And I want to give a special shout out to the Sunrise Movement, who really helped champion and push the Civilian Climate Corps to where it is today. And I think they've been instrumental in helping generate the support behind this program that I think will result in the program becoming a reality.
Politically activate yourself, you know, and do it pragmatically. Do it in a way where, you know, you realize the power that you do have. You know, while voting and policy are very important, there are things that you can do every day that are scalable to the life and resources that you have. And while this is really like all of our collective responsibility, you know, take a look at the situation as it's arising and, you know, see where you fit into it, because everyone does, everyone has to, you know. And I think a great first step in politically activating yourself can be joining a conservation corps.
Great points by everyone. We need resources. We need to make sure this is equitable and has a focus on communities and populations that have been traditionally left behind. The moment is now. I've been doing this for, like I said, about 30 years, and this is as close as I've ever seen us come. So I think to anyone listening, call your members of Congress, organize on the ground, talk about climate change. It can't wait. And so whatever way you choose to use your influence, do it and do it now.
We've dedicated the last 60 minutes or so using our platform to do what we can for the listeners today to get activated. And I'm so grateful for everyone spending time talking to us about this. I hope that people listening will get charged, contact their representatives, local, state, national, whatever it is, and do something. I thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful talking to each and every one of you. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners have too.
From the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University, the Berggruen Institute, and the Haas Center for Public Service at Stanford University, this has been Voices of Shaping Our Future. If you like our series, be sure to tell your friends to subscribe, and we encourage you to start your own conversations about the very topics we're discussing this season. The Voices of Shaping Our Future podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and is hosted by me, Alice Hsu. To learn more about me, you can find me on the Center for Deliberative Democracy's website, linked in the show notes. To learn more about the Berggruen Institute or the Haas Center for Public Service at Stanford University, please visit their websites, also linked in the show notes. Voices of Shaping Our Future is produced by Scott Simpson and Amy Locker and edited by Josh Williams. This series is executive produced by the Center for Deliberative Democracy at Stanford University, the Berggruen Institute, the Haas Center for Public Service at Stanford University, and Toby Agency.